I'll also make him cold.
I'm recording.
Okay, good. Good, I'll clean the scene.
Okay, we start the session. Come on, start the session.
No.
Hello.
Okay. So.
Let's do it.
Are we still following the schedule? Is it possible that?
Yeah, we have only 2 minutes to play.
I'm here.
We want to see a schedule.
I have it. I have it here.
So the first talk is François.
Yeah, okay. Okay. I've got it. Sorry.
Can you see my screen?
Great.
Can you see my screen now? Hello?
Hello.
You.
We can hear you.
Can you see my screen now?
Yeah, we can see your
screen. Yes, we can see your screen.
Okay. So should I start? I should start, I suppose.
All right.
Okay, so I'm François Charton, and I'm presenting Deep Learning for Symbolic Mathematics, which is about 1 year work done when I was visiting in Facebook AI, done with Guillaume Lample and Amaury Ayat from École des Ponts and Rutgers. Practically, what we're going to discuss is how we can apply natural language techniques to math problems, both symbolic and computational problem of mathematics, leveraging a modern NLP architecture, which is a transformer, and training everything on generated data sets of problems and solutions, and how this allows us to claim that we achieve state-of-the-art performance, basically on symbolic problem that we can do as well or better even than Wolfram Mathematica, Maple, the commercial solution in computer algebra. So to start, we start with a very basic intuition about neural networks. Over the recent years, neural network managed to achieve state-of-the-art performance on a very wide range of problems. And they're extremely good, they're extremely effective in pattern recognition, in a way it comes to recognizing dogs in pictures or locutors in recorded speech or something like this. They have proven to be less successful when it comes to symbolic computation, manipulating symbols. And to give an example that was quoted yesterday, in mathematics, they will fail on very simple tasks like integer multiplication. They will yield very bad results. But one surprising aspect of neural nets is that there is one domain of symbolic computation where they perform very well, and it is language. They do very well in recent tools do very well in natural language processing, especially in machine translation. So thinking of that, how do modern architecture work for natural language? And there are a common number of points. First, they work with sentence, which is only logical, but they work with sentence that they consider as just sequences of token. You know, when a model processes a sentence, it doesn't care whether the words in the sentence are nouns or verb, their semantic value, or the structure of the sentence. It's only, for the model, it's only a sequence of model. We talk of sequence to sequence model, sec to sec. Also, those models have absolutely no use for domain-specific knowledge, in this case, grammar or dictionaries or parallel translation of common sentence, anything semantic, anything syntactic. They don't care. The only thing they need, and they need a lot of it, is data. And if you give a language, such a language model, a lot of data, they can achieve state-of-the-art performance on many complex tasks. One of the most surprising being unsupervised machine translation, where you can see models you know, to translate from one language into another, say French into German, you just dump a lot of French into the machine, a lot of German too, and you don't need parallel sentences, you don't need translation, you don't need dictionaries. It manages and it achieves state of the art, meaning by that the kind of tool that are currently used by Facebook or by Google. So our starting point was said, could we do this in math? After all, math is a language. And the data problem is not a problem in math because it's easy to generate sets of problem and solution. Also, you can think that problem solving in math is some sort of an instance of language translation, machine translation. Basically, when you solve a problem, you translate the problem into the solution. Of course, there are also reasons to wonder why this could even happen, because learning mathematics from examples is a very counterintuitive idea. We don't learn mathematics this way. And also, mathematics is a very theory and rule intensive subject. So being able to do anything advanced in math without the help of a theory, like in a model, a language model not using grammar, is something that looks like a big gamble. But anyway, what we want to do is this machine translation for mathematics. And we can consider that there are three steps to do this. The first thing is that we need to bring math to the sec-to-sec models. So we need to represent math problems and solution as sequences. Then we will need to generate data sets to train our problems, to train our models. And finally, we will need to actually train the models. So representing problems as object, mathematical object as sequences of token is like treating mathematics as a natural language. What does this mean? So the good news is that a lot of parts of mathematics are already sequences of tokens, variables, functions, symbols, they're tokens in their own, you know, by nature. And you have punctuation, so everything is sequenced. Also, numbers are represented as sequences of tokens. That's positional notation, which we use all the time. And this goes for integers, but this goes also for scientific notation for floating points. So there's a lot of material that is already in sequence format. The only difficulty is representing expressions, such as functions or equations. But we all know that expressions can be represented as trees. I mean, it's been done in logic since at least the 1930s. It's been done in computer science, known as syntax tree, abstract syntax tree, parse tree, etc. And I give you a couple of examples here of different mathematical objects represented as trees. So on the left, you have the simplest kind, which is a basic integer calculation. Then in the middle, you would have a function, and it's exactly the same tree, but I just added a couple of tokens. You know, I added variables like x, I added a new function like cosine, but it's still a tree. And then on the right, you have a differential equation, partial differential equation. I removed the equal zero term here. This isn't something we do consistently throughout this work. And I just add, you know, Greek letters because this is more useful in advanced mathematics, as we all know. We have functions represented as letters, and we have new operators like partial differentiations. So we say that pretty much every mathematical object can be represented as tree. And the good thing is that a tree can be enumerated. We use preordered enumeration, known in logic as Polish notation. And doing this, it means that every expression can be represented as a sequence. So we've explained how you can bring most problems or most formulations of mathematics into a sequence-to-sequence model. Before I close on this, I'd like to add a few comments on the use of trees. It might seem right now I'm using trees just as a fancy way to introduce sequences, but this is not the case. The use of trees is very important here for two reasons that I want to explain. The first thing is that many formal systems represent well-formed expressions as trees. You know, it's known in the old book by Curry as op systems as opposed to syntactical system, you know, linguistic system a la post. You would have op system that work like that. And the use of trees and sequence here shows that you could extend this logic to many other formal systems apart in or apart from mathematics. Second point is that the tree representation will prove to be very useful when we generate our data sets, because we will need to generate random expression. And the easy way to generate a random expression is to generate a random tree. There are things in the paper that explain how to do this. And then once you have the tree, you decorate it. Basically, you sample random operators for the internal nodes, and then sample for the leaves all the basic elements. In this case, it would be digits, numbers, variables. And then you enumerate that and you get an expression. So trees are useful because they make our method very general, and also because they help with the create random expressions. So we're going to use this formalism to two problems of symbolic mathematics integration. So we're given a function, given as a sequence of tokens as seen previously, and we want to find its antiderivative, another function represented as a sequence of tokens. And we'll also work on ordinary differential equation of the first and second order. Basically, it's the same thing, but under a more complicated relation. Instead of being given a star function, we're given a relation between a function and its derivatives, and we're supposed to find a solution to this. Why those two problems? Well, a couple of reasons. First, they're advanced problems taught at university level, so they're not basic mathematics. They're not trivial, they're not easy even for trained mathematicians. I mean, if any of us has to do something like this, we're trained, but we need paper and pencil and probably some time to carry out the integration. And it's also difficult for computers. I mean, there are algorithms, especially for integration, but they're difficult to implement and they do not always succeed in practice. And also there was a practical reason, which is it involves the number of mathematical tasks, one that involves a lot of pattern recognition. When I integrate a function, I look at the shape of the function and I know which shape substitutes to which other function when I integrate it. So it's the kind of thing where we thought that neural nets would stand a chance because they are good, as we've seen in the beginning, at pattern recognition. So now we need to generate data sets, and we need to generate data sets of problems and solutions for supervised learning. So how do we do it? First, for symbolic integration. So the naive approach to that, which we call the forward method, is that you just generate a problem, a random function, small f. Then you compute the antiderivative, the solution, big F, with a symbolic framework. So SymPy, Mathematica, something. You have a pair, rinse, repeat 40 million times, and you get a data set. The problem with that is that it works, and we built a data set out of that, this method. But the problem with that is that first it requires an external symbolic framework. Basically, you can only apply that to problems that you already know how to solve or solve partly. And second, because you use an external symbolic framework, you are constrained in your training set by the function that the symbolic framework can solve. So if you use SymPy, which was our case here, you are limited to the functions, to the only function that SymPy can integrate. Finally, it's very slow. So we use an alternative method, which we call backward. It's backward because in forward method, you generate a problem and calculate a solution. Here, we generate a solution and find its problem. So it starts in the same way. You generate a random function, big F, which is the solution. But it turns out that in this problem and many other problems, the backward solution is very easy because finding the problem amounts to computing the derivative, which is a much easier step and much easier to program or organize or do with an external tool than calculating the primitive. So you compute the derivative and get that. So this is the backward method. It's much faster. It's much easier to implement. It seems when you look at it like this that it will be equivalent to the other, but in fact there are differences and it's interesting to look at them. So here are examples of problems and solutions, so functions and integral calculated with the forward method. So you can see those, and these are typical. And here are things you calculate with the backward method. So forward, backward, forward, backward. You can see the difference. In the forward method, you get short problems that have long solutions. In the backward method, you get long problems that tend to have short solutions. Both are interesting, and we would love to solve those both. But what this shows is that generating data set is important because it will explore different parts of the problem space. You generate different subparts of the problem space by having different generators, forward and backward. To mitigate that, this, we use the third method, which relies on integration by part. I suppose you all know this. Integration by part relies on the property of the derivation of the product. And it's a backward method in spirit. Basically, you start from the solution, but you start from two solutions, big F, big, you calculate the differentials, small f, small g, just as in the backward method. And then you look up all the examples you have already done. And if it happens that you already know how to integrate small f, big g, then you get big F small g for free and the other way around. It looks a bit ludicrous. I mean, it's just a complicated way to do the same thing as the backward example, isn't it? But actually it is not, because first, this happens quite a lot of time if you generate millions of equations. And second, as you can see in the formula, the left part of the formula is smaller than the right part. And actually, when you look at the functions you generate with integration by part, it's a backward method, but it generates short problems.
I think we...
And with so keep in mind that we created three different instances of three different data sets for integration. So next point is ordinary differential equation. There's no forward method for those. So the method we use very quickly starts from a solution and observe that solution of first order differential equation are defined up to a constant. So we generate a random function with two variables, f of x and c, c being the constants and x being the variable. And then we solve in c. So we invert this equation, y equal f of x, c, to get the next one. And then we calculate the differential of this, which turns out to be first order differential equation that small f, the origin function, solves. Show this in an example. So we generate at the top a random function. Then you solve it in C. So you divide by X, calculate the exponential, multiply by X, and you get the second line. And then you can differentiate and simplify by eliminating the exponential, which is always non-zero, removing, and you end up with the differential equation, which is interesting because you obviously cannot read the solution in the equation. So it's a good equation for training. You don't have the solution inside the problem. Okay, this method is amenable to larger order. For order two, you would just notice that you had two integration constants. So you would repeat the process twice. So you start from a function with two constants, you solve in the first constant, differentiate, solve in the second, redifferentiate, and there you go. So having done that, we could build five data sets. Three data sets for integration, forward, backward integration by part, and two for OE. Our main data set for integration will be backward, and the big data sets will be 40 million examples, problems and solution, and the other one will be 20 million. Okay, so now in terms of model, this is the easiest or the simplest part. We use a transformer. I won't detail a lot on the transformer. Let's just say that it's the old model of machine translation transformer with two stack, an encoder, a decoder. Then it's your typical transformer with self-attention and feed-forward in each layer. It's a very run-of-the-mill transformer. We have six layers, encoder, decoder, and we have 512 dimension, and it has eight attention heads. It's trained like a good NLP model, so it's trained over cross-entropy loss, so the model doesn't know anything about math or anything like this. It used the ADAM optimizer, which is the typical thing. And we use very large batches of 256 examples, which required pretty big GPUs. But actually I've tried it with very small batches on smaller machines, and you can run it on a gaming machine. So far it has a GPU. It doesn't need huge batch to succeed. That's what I mean. The only thing a little less typical that we did is that we use beam search. So at inference, you know, in a transformer, the solution is built one token at a time. You generate the first, most likely first token, and then the second token, which is the most likely second token given the first token, and so on. The beam search consists in, instead of generating just the one most likely token, you generate, say, the three most likely. And with those, you generate the nine most likely two token sentences and keep the three best according to the probabilities, and so on. So this allows you to use the same model to generate several candidate solutions. And we use this as a way to provide a model with several guesses. So for instance, if our first attempt at integrating a function doesn't work, we try the second or third, etc., with the beam search. Finally, at evaluation, we train our model and then we test them on 5,000 held out samples from the same data set, same generator. We check that there is no overlap, so no test problem has been set during training. And to measure accuracy, we use an external tool, we use SymPy, Why do we do this? Because as you probably understand, most of the problem has multiple solution. Basically, there is the solution in my data set, but there are many other solutions because all solutions are depend on an integration constant that could vary. And besides, there are many ways to represent the same mathematical object with different expression. So instead of checking that we get the right expression that was in the training set, we check that we get a real solution of the problem, and this is done through a computer algebra. And we use beam search as explained before. So that's basically the model and the methods we use. So the results. So we have five data sets. So we have five columns here for the five data sets and three lines depending on whether you will use just one solution, that's beam size one or 10 or 50. First thing is for integration. So the three first column, you can see that we're well over 90%, close to 100%, even without beam. So if we add beam, it goes up, but there's little improvement when we start from 98%. And so we're close to 100%. So it means that the system can integrate pretty much every single integral you throw at it on the first try. Another point which is interesting is that we get pretty much the same result on the three different data sets. So the three generators. This is important because when you work from generated data, there's always a question, you know, a nag question that says, are your result due to the model or due to the data generation? Because somehow you generated easy problems or there was a kind of an exploit that the model could exploit in the data generation. The fact that you get the same result on different data set built in very different way, because the forward and backward data set are built in totally different ways, suggests that this is really the model that performs and not the generator. For ODE, the problems are more difficult, and the higher the degree, the more difficult the problem becomes. So results go down, and this is where you see the efficiency of beam search. You know, order one with beam search, yes, almost 95%, and order two is well above 80%, which is totally non-trivial. How does this compare to state of the art? So we compared with commercial packages. So we actually compare with Mathematica, MATLAB, and Maple, but Mathematica is much better on both those specific tasks. You can see that on our backward sample, Mathematica succeed about 85% of the time. We had a timeout set here for speed, but I tried with larger timeout and it never goes over 86-87%. And we're very close to 100%. So we're doing much better than Mathematica on this. For ODE, Mathematica catches up. ODE order one, we're on par, and ODE number two, order two it's better. But with beam size, we again do better than Mathematica. So practically on our data sets, we beat Mathematica, and we can say at least that we're state of the art. So having presented this, I'd like to discuss a few aspects of the project that have been discussed a lot during the review at IKEA. The first thing is about generalization. So when you do this kind of thing with deep networks, people say, okay, does it generalize? So there's an easy answer to this. The easy answer is, yes, it generalized because the samples we use for testing have not been seen at training, so they're brand new samples. This is an easy way out. The real question is that we're working from generated data, and training and test set come from the same generator. If we were to use this problem in the wild, whatever this means, it's obvious that the test set wouldn't come from the generator that was used to generate the training sample. So what would happen if we try that? So the first thing we try is, okay, let's train on the forward sample and test on the backward sample or the other way around. So on this table, you can see the lines correspond to the training sample and the columns are the test sample. So if you look at the first line, you can see the training data. If you train on the forward data, you get 95% performance when testing on the forward data. But if you test on the backward data, boom, you go down to 17 or something. It's non-trivial. It's not something, you know, the model has clearly learned something, but this is extremely disappointing. Same goes if you look at the backward data, train on backward data, test on forward, it's less bad, but it's still only 25%. It's not impressive at all. So what's happening, and is it extremely damning? So we already discussed the reason of that. The problem is that the backward sample is made of long problem with short solutions. The forward problem is short problem and long solution. So what's happening when you train on the forward model is that you're repeating this 50 million times and you're showing this example to the model, which has only this to learn about integration. And after 50 million of examples, you can be sure that the model will have learned the first rule of integration, the cardinal rule of integration, that it is an expansion, something that turns a short sentence into a long sentence. And why will the model believe so? Because it has seen it consistently happen over 50 million examples. And then comes the test time and boom, you arrive with this. You arrive with an adversarial example, which provides something totally different, cases where the problems are long and the results are short. So to give kind of a metaphor, you could imagine that if you were training a model that recognized breeds of dog, if you train it on small dogs, poodle dogs, you know, dogs the size of cats, and tested it on big dogs like shepherd dogs and things like that, you would pretty much observe the same problem. But the problem, no one would think that the problem is that it's about pattern image recognition or dog recognition in this case. It would come with the data set. The same problem happens here. What we see here is that the forward and backward samples are too different or represent two different parts of the problem space for the model to be able to generalize from one into the other. So what would be the solution? Well, we've seen that with the integration by part. Remember, the integration by part examples tended to be in the middle. This is a distribution of the length of the expression in the, for the left part is the problems and right part is the solution. You can see that integration by part stand in the middle in that the distribution of lengths on the problems is pretty much the forward distribution, but the distribution of lengths on the solution is pretty much a backward distribution. So it's in the middle. So suppose we now train on forward, backward, and test on integration by part and read my first line. So forward, you're 95, backward, you're down at 15. But if you test on integration by part, which is a totally different sample, you're back at 90. So the problem is not really out of domain generalization. It's the nature of the domain that you use on an out of domain basis. It will work so far the new domain is not too removed from the training domain. And from this, you can have an idea on how to improve generalization on that kind of tool. Basically, the idea is that you will have to build a training set made of several diverse generators in order to cover a larger fraction of the problem space. This is what you can see on the third line of this graph, where you can see that if you train on a mixture of backward and integration by part and test on forward, you double the result that you got when you were on backward. So that would be the solution to improve generalization. In other words, what I'm trying to say in that is that with those kind of model on generated data, the problem of generalization comes less from the model than from the generation and the training samples that you build. So it's attention to the generating procedure is crucial here. With a closing, a last point about generalization, which is something that, you know, the model still generalize well about. Remember that in the forward data sets, all the problem we use for training are problem that SymPy could solve. So we were limited to train on only the cases that SymPy could solve. Interestingly, there are a number of cases that a training model can solve after being trained that SymPy cannot solve. So the model can generalize beyond the generator and SymPy. It's an interesting aspect to observe. Last thing I wanted to note, because it says something about what the model is learning and how the model is learning about math. We talked about the beam search so far as a way to get second chances. Basically, if you miss or if you get the wrong solution at first try, you can get a second or a third or a fourth try in the beam search. But what happens when the first solution is correct? So here we have a differential equation and we have the beam. So those are the 10 solutions, the 10 best solutions according to the model. And the first one, which is one on the top left, is actually the correct solution. But if you look at the solution, they all look a bit alike. They're different, but they still look alike. Actually, they're all correct solution to the same problem. And they're all equivalent solution to the same problem. And this is interesting because our problems have many solutions because of integration constant, because one solution can be rewritten in different way. So you can say that there is an equivalence relation on the space of expression, which is like the equivalent. It's not exactly an equality because there's an integration constant, but you see what I'm meaning there. It's something which is akin to simplification in mathematics. And it wasn't something that the model was trained on, but they are retrieved from the beam, which means that the model, the embedding learned by the model, put these expression in closed places, the beam retrieve elements which are closed in terms of embedding. So it means that such a model could be used as a pre-training tool for simplification or for equivalent expression. And it also means that the model has learned something it wasn't really trained on. Okay, so this was the first paper I wanted to talk about, deep learning for symbolic math. And I now want to present, we have 10 minutes to present the next follow-up study that we did last spring, and we actually published it in June, which is called Deep Differential Stability, Learning Advanced Computation, for example, and was written with Amaury Ayat from Ecole des Ponts, Rutgers, and Guillaume Lancre. The idea is that we have just shown that we can train deep models, deep learning models, to do symbolic math. But if we wanted deep models to do math, we would need not only to do symbolic math, but also to be able to do computations. Computation being both arithmetic and those approximate computation on real number that we do all the time when we do math. You know, multiplying matrices, inverting them, calculating eigenvalues, these pop up every time. So the question is, could we do that? We already know that neural nets are not good at arithmetic. Could they be good at computation? So that was the theme of the paper. So for this, we went on studying differential equation, but now we're focusing on differential systems. So a differential system is an n-dimensional version of a differential equation. Basically, it's a system of n first-order differential equation with n variables, okay? And these kind of systems appear everywhere in science, in physics, in economics, in biology, in chemistry, everywhere, because they represent basically the gradient of some dynamic in one point. So it's a function f that gives a gradient in every point, and you have trajectories, and the solution of the trajectories made possible under this gradient. Most of those systems, almost all of them, cannot be solved analytically. So the previous method will not work. But what's interesting is that we have a lot of mathematical theory because they're very useful, they're very well studied. And there are mathematical theory which allow us to guess the properties of the solution around points of equilibrium, that is points where f of x is equal to zero, the zeros of x, which are places where the gradient is zero, which could be either minimum, local maximum, or saddle points. And we have one theorem, the spectral mapping theorem, which says that if we have a system like this one, and if we take the Jacobian, which is the derivative, well, the matrix of differentials of f, and evaluate it at this point, and then calculate its eigenvalues, the real part of the largest real part of eigenvalue will give us the stability of the equilibrium. Basically, if it's negative, the equilibrium is stable, and the largest real part is the speed of convergence. In practice, showing this on an example, you start with two equations in two variables. So if I were to do this doing mathematics, I start with symbolic mathematics. I'm going to differentiate the two equations with respect to the two variables. So I get the Jacobian, which I will then evaluate in one point. And then I will compute the eigenvalues of the Jacobian. The eigenvalues can be complex because the matrix is not symmetric. And I take the real parts, and the largest real part in this place is negative, so this will be a stable system, okay? And so we want to train our transformer with that, so we're given a system, it's like before, but instead of having just one sequence for one function, we now have n. So we have n functions corresponding to the system f, and we want to predict convergence speed at a given equilibrium point. So what we're predicting is a number, which is actually for the model is still language model. So it's a sequence of token representing a real number. So -4.41 exponential -1, something like this, you see. And we want to check how it works. So normally determining the sign would be enough to check for stability, but here we try to predict the largest eigenvalue. And we predict whether it's within 10% of the correct value. We had to add the value you know, some kind of figure of merit, but it could be something else. And what's very interesting is that despite the calculation being a very complex mix of computation and symbolic mathematics, a fairly large transformer, you see 8 layers, 1024 dimensions, could predict almost 85% of the case for system between 2 and 6 variables. What's also interesting is that even relatively shallow transformer, just 4 layers, 512 dimensions, would already do pretty well on small degrees. So this shows that it's not only symbolic and pattern matching things like integration that can work with transformer, you can also train them to do those mixture of computation and symbolic math. So we wanted to push that further, and the next step if you want to study differential system is controllability. So basically it's the same differential system, but now it has more parameters. So you still have n differential equation with n variables, but you add the p new variables, which are control variables. And the idea, the question then is, can you choose the values of u, the additional parameters, so that the system can go from point A to point B in a given amount of time? This is an important problem. This is what lands modules on the moon or on Mars. So it's very useful. And it's math, basically it's applied math from the end of the 20th century. And the Kalman conditions say that in this case, you will have basically two Jacobians, one Jacobian for the native variable and one Jacobian for the control variable. And you can build a matrix out of them. And the system is controllable if the matrix is a high rank. The example here, you have a system, so two equations, but you have a third variable. You can see u in the first equation. So you then differentiate it, and you now have two Jacobians, and then you calculate the Jacobian in a specific point. You compute a control matrix by multiplying the two Jacobians you had, and you calculate the rank. And again, you can generate large sets. And in this case, we're trying just to predict controllability. So it's a 0-1, so we're using the transformer just to predict a binary signal. And you can see that a very large model, well, a large model, 6-layer 512, achieve almost 100% of prediction in this case, which is considered much more complicated than the previous one, but the results are excellent. Even more interesting is that very, very small number, small models, like 1-layer, and 64 dimension, you cannot use such a model to do language. It's too shallow, too simple. Models that wouldn't be wide enough to do natural language still can manage something on those problems. So we don't understand what's happening, but what we observe is that transformers are pretty good at getting this kind of signal and identifying them. You can push this forward because in the case of controllability, one second question you could ask is, how can you calculate a matrix that achieves controllability? And this is given by a formula. So you want a matrix K such that in every point, Kx, if you set U to K times X, the position, you get control. And one solution is this one. So you can see it's a very big formula with integration, matrix product, exponentiation, matrix inversion, everything. And you try to predict this time a matrix, so a set of numbers. So we tried to train the model on this. And as expected, it doesn't work that well. It's getting too complicated for the transformer, but still, if we try to predict within 10% for all the matrix coefficients, so max distance in terms of distance between matrix coefficients is 10%, we can see that we can still recover 50% of the matrix with a degree 3 system, which is totally non-trivial. You cannot get that randomly, and it's very surprising. But it doesn't survive dimensionality. You know, if you get 4, 5, 6 equations, the model totally gets lost. But what's interesting, just as we saw with the equivalence relation, is that the matrix returned by the system are still correct feedback matrix. That means that they do solve the controllability problem. So whereas the model cannot learn the exact matrix that was sent or the complicated calculation that was shown previously, The model still learns some kind of property of the system, which allows it to solve in 2 times out of 3 that problem. So that's That's what I had to say. So the main conclusion is that deep language models can learn symbolic mathematics and advanced computation from examples, from generated examples. There are many strange things that we don't understand. It seems that the model do not work like we do. They don't follow classical theory. The first thing to suggest this is that what's difficult for a human is not necessarily difficult for the model. This is very clear in the case of differential systems. The model seems to have an easier time with problems that would seem difficult to us and seem to have more difficulty, say, with the spectral mapping theorem, which is could be considered as simpler. And shallow models, small for NLP, sometimes work for math. So the parallel with language stops there. It's a different subject, in fact. So last point is that it's really a new field of research, in our opinion. There are lots of potential application to experimental science. It's probably an interesting framework also for understanding machine learning, because if we can understand how transformer learn math, we know something, since we know a lot about math, we can learn something about how transformers and machine learning learns. And an interesting question, at least one that comes as a takeaway from me on the last paper, is I'm really wondering whether if a machine learned math, it could learn exactly the same math as us. It seemed to process on a different way, and this is very strange. So here are the references of the paper, so two papers. And for the first paper, the one with Guillaume, we have our data set and the code is available. Thank you very much.
Okay, so.
Yeah. Okay, so we have one online question. So Sean, can you mute?
Okay, hello.
Hello.
So I have a few questions. Hi. I have a few questions. So the first one is, so for the first experiment that you did, have you tried to integrate, like to give some test sample, to try to integrate something that cannot be, that is non-integrable, like e to the power of x squared, like something that's not easily integrable without numerical method?
Yeah, we did try. Well, we actually did try a number of things on this line. The thing is that the model will always provide you with a solution. You know, that's the principle of a language model. It doesn't know that something is not doable. So you will just get a solution which is strange. In general, it will sort of look like a solution. So you will have exponentials and stuff like that. So it would look like a potential candidate, but it will just be wrong. The model, one important point is that the model is not able to tell you that something is not integrable. This is not... the model cannot do that.
Okay. So, okay, thanks. The second question is, so when you try to basically serialize a tree, you use pre-order traversal of a tree. Have you tried to use a post-order or in-order or other kinds of serialization? And have you ever seen some different results?
So we haven't tried. There was
in
a reason
to
why.
Pre-order.
Yeah, there was a reason why we choose pre-order, because in a transformer, the decoder of the transformer goes left to right. And so it's a bit logical that you would want to learn in a left to right way. So if I were doing the post order and inverted the direction of the decoder, I would get pretty much the same result because it would be totally equivalent. I have no idea on how the in order would perform. It would be worth a try. I shall try that.
Okay. Thanks. The third question is, so when you try, so in the end, so when you try to make inference using the transformer model, first of all, you get a sequence and you basically retrieve a tree from a sequence. Have you, like from the testing data, have you tried to get some trees, like try to, have you ever obtained some sequences that when you try to get a tree that is actually not a legal tree, something like that?
Yeah, this is a very good question.
What's the proportion of the...
This is a very good question, and this is an important point about transformer. When you start training transformer in the beginning, you get a lot of invalid sequences. But the validity of sequences is gotten very, very fast during training. On a trained model, you have very, very few invalid sequences. On average, it's less than 1%, it's probably 0.5% or something like that. So practically, after a while, all sequences become valid, because I suspect the transformer learns how to build a valid sequence very early in the training process. This is relatively consistent with language models. There are cases where you tend to get more invalid sequences, which are typically when you start to explore cases which are very different from what the model got. For instance, in all our training models, we tend to have functions with small values of integers. If you start feeding a lot of more integers than there were in the training sample, then somehow the model loses ground because it's too far from its training sample, and you start getting invalid examples. So practically, you tend, on a trained model, you tend to have no more invalid sentences after training. So far, you remain on areas which correspond to the type of sentences you train the model on.
Vakos, can you ask your question?
Yeah, so thank you for the talk. So I wanted to maybe to comment first on the question of Sean, like about prefix notation and normal notation. So recently I experimented also with language models for symbolic tasks. It was premise selection in my case. And I realized that not always prefix notation is better actually than just normal classical notation. So because my intuition was that, yeah, prefix notation is more compact, more like better for these models which like try to produce a linear sequence of symbols. So this is just a comment. And I have two questions on the topic of like generalization versus memorization. I was quite impressed by the results you presented in the paper, and actually I tried to reproduce them, and I did like some investigation about the data set. So for example, I noticed that in the testing set, like for some tasks, like for example integration by parts, I see many like very simple examples in the training set actually. And for example, if I substitute all constants by just one symbol representing a constant, then like the overlap between the testing set and the training set is like 70%. 70% of testing examples is the same modulo constant for this integration by parts. For other, it's lower, but still. So this like this motivates a question maybe. Did you try to somehow make sure that these testing examples are like really maybe, I don't know, separate from the training examples?
Yes and no. Practically, we noticed the problem with overlap, and there was a specific problem with the integration by part because it was extremely slow. I mean, generating the integration by part example took like 2 weeks of calculation on the Facebook cluster, which is very big. So it was a bit unreasonable because it starts very well, and after a while you all end up always getting the same. And we have, it's one characteristic of this model is that we sort of generated expression by having the same proportion of expression with only one operator, two operators, three operators. So you could say that the number of operators, or the size of them, it's uniform with respect to the number of operators in the data set. So in a way, you have lots of short expression, and you could say that the model memorized the short expression, whereas it will generalize on the large expression. We have examples that show as soon as you're above 5 or 6 operators, the thing is exponential and goes very fast. But we have a lot of very small expression that the model probably memorized. And this probably reflects in the training set. I would agree with that. We had tests done by modifying, you know, the training set, by changing the constant or changing a little, and observe similar thing. It could be interesting. I mean, the data is available, so it could be interesting to try to see how we could generalize or maybe just eliminate the short examples from the training set because they're sort of easy. So maybe the best way would be to have a training set which only contains fairly long expressions so that we would only test on difficult samples and not on the easy one that were memorized.
Okay, thank you. And second question, some comment?
No, I'm just wondering whether we'll be able to run all questions.
So just a quick question. So did you maybe try to analyze what is the correlation between the number of training examples and the performance of the trained network? Because your training set is very, very large and also your training was very, very long. And I wonder maybe if you did this analysis.
Yeah, well, we have learning curves. The thing is that you get a fairly, the learning curves are very typical, especially for integration. I mean, you don't need the 40 million examples to train because after a few dozens of the epochs are usually 300,000 cases. And after a few dozen, 20, 30 epochs, you're already at a fairly high level. So a few million would be enough. But to get to the 90%, then, you know, it's a very slow, it's logistic-like. So you take a lot of expressions. You could achieve it with smaller samples, especially if you eliminate the short expressions.
Okay, thank you. So that's all from me.
Bartosz, can you ask your question?
Oh, Bartosz has just asked the question. So the next guy is Stanislas and Lots.
Okay, Stanislas.
Thanks. First thing I wanted to mention is that at OpenAI, we've reproduced the results successfully, which I think is awesome. The question that I had, do you think there's anything special about beam search compared to sampling n times? Because we know for language models that when you beam search, you kind of have samples with lower entropy that are somewhat atypical compared to the original distribution.
No, I think we used beam search because we knew how to do it at the time and it seemed like a good idea. The paper was written very fast. I think the point of beam search or any other search is that they search the same place in the embedding, in the final embedding. And this is why you get good solution because good solution are embedded in closed places. But it could be beam search or anything else, I think.
Cool, thanks.
Last but not least, Vlad.
Yeah. Thanks for the talk. My question is about benchmarks. I'm wondering if there are any sort of non-generated external benchmarks for integration where you could have maybe a more even playing field between the people and your system.
Yeah, that's a very good question. So we thought a lot about that. So we first considered the textbooks, but the problem is that the examples we had are totally unnatural because textbooks are meant just for textbooks for learning. So they are very short examples, very specific. They will tend to be excellent. You know, this is what computer algebra is based on. So they will be 100% because they're almost hard coded. And they are very close. We've noticed that we tend to be better on long expression because it's more meat, you know, for the model to digest. The closest thing we found was something called Ruby, R-U-B-I. Which is rule-based integration, which is a huge data set, which is used, it's been developed by a couple of people, the name escaped me, but there are a couple who developed that. And so there's a big data set which can be used as a test set for Mathematica and MATLAB and all that. So we've actually trained on Ruby and noticed that we could achieve similar performance on Ruby, you know, when trained on Ruby, tested on Ruby with the same method. We didn't push that much forward, but yes, there are a few models like that. The only difficult part we have with those external things is that we don't really know what the distribution of integrals would be, you know, if it were to be used in the wild. And probably those textbook or even the databases done like textbook bases might be a bit biased towards, you know, known rules or known principles. But yeah, we try Ruby if that can help you.
Thank you.
So, plenty of questions. Thank you for answering all of them. Thank you again. Fascinating talk.
Thank you.
next speaker unmute?
They can always unmute themselves. So it's...
Hello. Yeah, I'm here.
Okay.
Hey. Can you hear me?
Yes.
You should share your screen.
Oh yeah. Sure. Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
Can you see my screen?
Yes.
Okay. Let me just get started. Hello everyone, I'm Yu Huai. I'm a PhD student at the University of Toronto. So this work I'm gonna talk about inequality theorem proving dataset, and this is a joint work with Albert, Roger, and Jimmy at University of Toronto. So in our opinion, we think theorem proving faces two main challenges, and that is probably trivial for everyone. The first is learning challenge, and the second is the data challenge. In learning challenge, we believe the problem very specific or very special in the theorem proving data set is that we have this very non-ID distribution generalization problem, because in this case, you have to generalize to unseen theorems of very different types than the ones that you might see in the training time. So the usual ID assumption breaks in this case. And this is particularly hard for the current existing machine learning technology we have. So obviously we need an algorithm that overcomes this kind of distribution shift. So the specifics of this kind of distribution shift, we will also discuss that later in the talk. However, the other question is, can we actually evaluate this kind of behavior? Whether we can reliably evaluate whether the agent can overcome this kind of distribution shift and across different kinds of distribution shifts. So this comes to the second challenge. Yes, can we evaluate on this kind of behavior or ability? The problem is that human data are quite messy. It's very hard to do those kind of control experiments to understand what exactly made the experiments fail or agent fail. And on the other hand, dataset is very scarce compared to other ML datasets. This is mainly because the formalization of mathematics is expensive, and we don't have that much of data for training for a lot of mathematics. So in this work, we present this inequality theorem proving dataset. So this is a theorem proving dataset consisting of theorem proving, inequality theorems, and we designed various dimensions of generalization, which you can generate all these kind of distribution shifts, training and testing using our synthetic generator. And the theorem proving interface mimics the modern ITP interactive theorem provers. And another benefit of this theorem proving data set is that it is very lightweight, and it provides fast simulations. For example, if you want to do search, this is very easy to do here compared to the more mature theorem proving assistant. But of course, I'm not saying this can be this can replace all the other mature theorem proving system. This is just a one that maybe a good test for earlier research purposes. So it's a very complementary theorem proving assistant to all the existing ones. So one of such problem in our data set is something like here, where you have some premises and you want to prove some expression like this. Okay, so This is the kind of axioms that we consider. There are mostly field axioms, and so some of them are for example, commutativity, distributivity, and associativity, and the more interesting ones are in the first principle of inequality, additional commutativity, and second principle of inequality, and square greater or equal to zero, these kind of things. So basically, we are trying to come up with a, we came up with a theorem proving generator that utilizes all these kind of axioms to produce the theorems in our data sets. Okay, so the proof system, as I said, mimics the modern ITP. For example, this is a proof of A plus B plus C equal to C plus A plus B in Lean. There are essentially two steps. We first try to do commutativity on A plus B, and then we do another step on associativity for C. And similarly, in our proof, we basically, first of all, represent every of the expression in a graph, expression tree. So it's simply like a computational tree. And we're the action or the tactic is applied to a particular node on this tree. So for example, additional commutativity is applied to this node, which stands for the entire A plus B plus C, and then you can sort of basically flip the operands of the plus, and then that's the resulting graph. Similarly, you apply the additional associativity to the other nodes here, and then eventually when the two sides of the tree matches, that's when the goals are cleared and the theorem is proved. So essentially this mimics the current ITP with the extra flexibility that you can actually apply the actions to the nodes of the graph. So that's another advantage of using this theorem proving assistant. Okay, so the main question is that how do we actually generate theorem? So as I told you, this is a synthetic theorem generation data set. The goal is to generate a theorem with specified axiom order and proof length. Axiom order refers to a sequence of axioms that we want the final proof to consist of. And so now the basically a naive strategy is pretty simple, which is that we start with some very initial premises, something like A plus A, and then we iteratively apply the axioms to some random variables in this expression at every step. And eventually we hope that, you know, the resulting statements are still true, and the trajectory from the initial premises to the eventual statement forms a good data set, form a good data point or proof sequence. So what's wrong about this idea? Well, there are two problems. One is that you may see that if you do this, then it's very not clear how do you actually able to chain up the intermediate proof steps. I will show an example in the next slide. So another thing is that some theorems actually need additional premises. That means, for example, something like first principle of inequality, you need to have some premises that is about something, some inequality statements, but how do we have those in order to apply this axiom? Well, our strategy basically is the following. So for solving the first problem, we substitute the old construction into the new construction. To illustrate that, I will show an example in the next slide. For the second problem, which we want to have additional premises, we're basically making up new premises on the fly. This means that we actually write some rules for these kind of axioms, and then we make up those kind of premises so that the theorems can be applied these kind of axioms. Okay, so let me show you one example. So this is a very simple example where we start with the initial premises or initial condition A plus A equal to B plus, sorry, A equal to A, B equal to B, C equal to C. These are just the trivial premises. And then the axiom orders I'm writing here consists of two axioms. One is the additional commutativity denotes by AC, and then the other is also additional commutativity. Essentially, what we want here is that we want to have a proof that consists of two steps. The first step applies additional commutativity. The second step also applies additional commutativity. All right, so if we do the naive strategy, we will start with just randomly sample some variables from this initial condition, for example, A plus A and B. And then we do this additional commutativity on top of it that it gave us this current statement that is A plus B equal to B plus A. So that's a good progress because now we actually can actually have something to prove. So if you want to prove this, that is just one step by applying this. So that's a good progress. The second thing we can just go on and then apply the additional commutativity again to some random variables on the current expression. For example, A plus B is the first variable that we pick, and then the second variable is some C that's chosen from the initial premises. But now the problem happens, which is that now we see the new theorem or new expression we have is A plus B plus C equal to C plus A plus B. And to prove this, we just need to, again, just use one step of additional commutativity. And that already proves it. We actually don't need to go back to the go back to this step and then prove, two steps of additional commutativity. Essentially, this means that if you apply these kind of axioms in this kind of random or naive manner, each of the new step just makes up a new proof example, but it's only one with only one proof step. So this is bad because we want to have a theorem proving a generator that generates proof of any steps. So the idea is very simple. We simply substitute 2 into 3. So now we substitute B plus A into A plus B. So this becomes A plus B plus C equal to C plus B plus A. And in order to prove this, we actually need to utilize these two different steps. One is to permute this one, and then the other one is permute A plus B to, back to the B plus A back to the A plus B. So this is just one example of this generator algorithm. Essentially, we wrote for each of the theorem, for each of the axiom, we wrote these kind of rules of how to substitute so eventually our generator are able to produce these proofs with these axioms of any length and given any kind of axiom orders. All right, so let me go back to here. So yeah, so basically theorem a generator looks like this. We start with some initial condition, and then we are given some axiom orders, and then we're gonna generate the eventual theorem here. So here are some just statistics of the data set. So here is like the average number of nodes of the expression in our proof. So you can see that the average number of nodes for a proof length of number of 7 is around 40 to 50, which is still reasonable. So we did a little bit optimization so that the expression don't look so long and synthetic. We still want to make sure that these theorems are more human-like or more interesting. And also, we also see that here, the problem length in characters is around 50. For the field axioms, and this is for the outer field axioms. Any other statistics are in the paper. Okay, so go back to the original question. We want to evaluate generalization, and so we basically come up with six various dimensions of generalization. These include the randomness in the generation algorithm. When we sample random variables, that's when where the randomness comes from. And then we also want to vary the initial premises, axiom combinations, axiom orders, and number of unique axioms, and the proof length. So all of these will be illustrated later when I present the results. Okay, so I think now I'm going to the results section. So in experiment, what we are doing mostly is just a behavior cloning experiments or imitation learning. So essentially we have these proof sequences we generate along with the theorem, and then we basically do imitation learning or behavior cloning on these data sets. So we fixed test set of 10,000 theorems, and then we generate training problems on the fly. But we also make sure there's no overlap with the test set. So at every iteration, we basically generate 1,000 new training problems, and we train on them for 10 epochs before we move on to the next iteration. And in total, there are 1,500 iterations for the experiments. Okay, so first of all, let me show you some architecture comparison. So essentially what we're trying to compare is graph neural nets, TrueLSTM, and bag of words models. And you can see that the graph neural nets here sort of is the orange one, and the TrueLSTM is the gray, and then the bag of words is the blue one. You can see for this data set, it is clear that the bag of words could not solve the problem. And that's just a sanity check because the problem does make use of a lot of structures of the computational graph. And the graph neural nets behave similarly to the TrueLSTM. In some cases, it's worse. In most other cases, it's better. But of course, we still aim to probably find a better architecture. For example, let's say we want to actually try transformer on this, but the current framework is a little bit unsuitable for transformer, but we are still gonna try it later on when I discuss the future directions. So for the type of graph neural nets, we used graph isomorphism network with 512 dimension, hidden dimension, and there are six layers. All right, so that's just some statistics, some details. And then we also try to show you, we also show here that, what about the randomness? So we basically want to show you the generalization result. And the first generalization dimension is the randomness that comes from the generation algorithm, so the sampling of the random variables. And then you can see that the agent is pretty good at this. So the training and testing are not much different. That shows the agent is able to actually generalize to these kind of distribution change. This is not distribution shift. This is just IID assumption, IID generalization. And the second is the initial condition generalization. So remember, in this kind of theorem generation, we have the initial condition A equal to A, B equal to B, and then we simply just want to start with some other initial condition and then try to see if the resulting algorithm actually is the same. And in this case, we also see that the training and testing are pretty much the same. I think this is because the initial condition may actually end up in the same distribution as the original one. So maybe this is also considered more into the IID generalization domain instead of the out of distribution generalization domain. So the more interesting one is the following four generalization dimensions. The first is the axiom orders. For example, in this case, we have the axiom orders from AC to FPI. whether we can just change it to some other axiom order, which starts with FPI, then AC. And in this case, we are showing you some of the results here and with different kinds of axiom orders in the training set. So there are 100, 500, 2000, and 5000. You can see that in the case when there are very little axiom orders diversity in the training set, the training and testing is pretty bad. So you can see a large drop in generalization from almost 80 to 90% success rate down to only 10 to 40 success rate. But of course, when you increase the number of axiom orders, then the training and testing becomes much better. For example, in the end, if you increase to 5,000, the train and test almost matches. So, but this presents a particular problem or challenge for us because we probably don't have that many axiom orders in real human data set. And the question is, how do we overcome this kind of distribution shift? Also, for axiom combinations, that means whether we can just change to another kind of axiom combinations from AC and FP to something like AC to AA. And again, similarly to axiom order previously, we also see very bad generalizations when the number of axiom order, axiom combinations are small in the training set. You can see that we have also experienced a very big conformation degradations when the axiom combinations are small, but then we also still improves when we have more axiom combinations. So this presents the second challenge of how to overcome this kind of lack of axiom combinations in the actual human data set. And then we also are, sort of evaluate the number of distinct axioms in the generation. So what if we have not only these two, but also something like AA? So the number of axioms we are calling, we are using the letter K to denote them. So in this case, original theorem is K equal to 2. And if we use three axioms, then the K equals 3. And in this case, we also perform this kind of string and testing between, if you train on, for example, some K equal to 3, what happens if you evaluate on the distribution of K equal to 5? And you can see that, for example, for the agent that's trained on K equal to 3, it does pretty well on K3 distribution, but the performance gets worse and worse when you increase the number of axioms combinations. Similarly, for the other case, when you have when you are training on axioms of much larger number of axiom combinations, for example, 7 here, it also experiences performance degradations when you decrease the number of axiom combinations. So this shows that yes, there are some challenges even in generalizing from, you know, the larger the or the more complicated problem to the smaller problem, to the easier one. Lastly, this is a proof lens that people usually know about. This is the proof line. This is a generalization on the number of proof steps. So we want to have, for example, from training on proof of 3 to steps longer than 3. As you can expect, this is also pretty bad. So for example, if you train on length of 3, then the performance decreases much very bad when you increase the length of the proof. All right, so lastly, I just want to discuss one thing that we try to improve the generalization performance. So the question we want to ask is whether planning help in terms of generalization. So what we did was we performed the MCTS over the axiom space at test time. So basically this means that we only search over the axiom space, because if you want to search over axiom space and an argument space, then that's just too much. We also follow the alpha zero approach for training a value function to replace the row outs. and that speeds up the inference time. And we can see that actually it helps a lot by using the planning, demonstrated by our data set. So you can see that we can actually get a performance from 25 success rate to 40% success rate, almost like double the success rate. And also in the case when you are trained on longer proofs, it also generalizes much better. So yeah, so that's just one thing that you can try to basically use this data set to illustrate, for example, your method actually works in terms of generalization. And also you can see that the length of the proof decreases from 3.8 to 3.3 or something like 8.4 to 7.5. This is the number of steps of the proofs that that the agent generates. All right, so just a summary. What we did was to introduce a data set that allows benchmarking six dimensions of generalization. These include randomness in generator algorithms and the initial premises, axiom combinations, axiom models, number of unique axioms, and the proof length. We see there are challenges in the last four generalization dimensions, and we advocate for a better algorithm to overcome these kind of distribution shift. And we also find that on the architectural comparison, for this kind of data set, the graph structure is necessary. And we also find that the planning algorithm like MCTS can greatly boost the performance in generalization. And okay, so I think that's it. And stay tuned because we are also working on a sequence-to-sequence formulation instead of the graph formulation so that it's more closely aligned with the existing interactive theorem provers and also provides opportunity to use transformers on this kind of data set. So that's my presentation and any questions?
We're running low on time, so I guess we have time for one question. Me in the room or online? Okay.
I can do one.
Yeah.
Can you say a bit more what are the parameters of the MCTS of the Monte Carlo tree search? Like, how do you do it? Like, have you looked at how the results change if you modify the parameters?
Yes, so I do remember the results change a little bit, but I mostly follow the hyperparameters from the AlphaZero paper. So so like the CCT is about one, and another parameter is, I think the number of simulations at every time step is around 100. So that's the hyperparameter I used. If you increase to 200, the performance gets a little bit better, but not too much. So that's my feeling.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Stanislas. Can you take the spotlight?
I am allowing. Oh, sorry. I need to come back. I'll be back in a second to allow Zoom to share my screen. Let me try to share only one screen, maybe. Oh, yeah, it's good. Perfect. Okay. Can you see my screen?
Yes.
Cool. Perfect. So thank you very much. My name is Stanislas. I'm an engineer researcher at OpenAI. I'm going to be presenting GPTF and the associated paper, Generative Language Modeling for Automated Serum Proving. It's a work I've been doing with Elias at Skiver. Okay, so GPTF really attempts to explore the application of language model, generative language model to automated serum proving. the one capability that we are particularly interested into is the capability of those models to generate original terms, which is completely lacking from current ATPs. If you think about proving an existential theorems, often the way to prove it is to provide a witness, and the generation of the original term that represents that witness is something that current ATPs can do. And we hope that generative models can achieve. Also, formal mass is super interesting, we believe, as a domain of application, because it is reasoning complete in the sense that an advance in formal mass, I think, is widely believed to be an advance in reasoning by the broader machine learning community. And moreover, it's amenable to search and data generation, which is crucial because there is a very big lack of data sets around reasoning, and they are generally very scarce. So we've been attacking the MetaMask formal environment. It is a pretty special system. It has a bunch of advantages. First, it's super fast, it's super simple. It's very easy to implement a kernel, takes you an afternoon. It may take another day to implement a fast parser for the grammar, but it's really a great test bed for experiments because it can change things easily. It has a large enough database of theorems, 38K theorems, 3 million proof steps. It's nothing compared to Mizar, but it's not negligible either. And it's also, it's straightforward to extract a very clean data set of given a goal in those proof. What was the proof step that was applied and what are the subgroups that were generated? It does have some disadvantage. It has no high level tactics, no automation whatsoever. So whatever system you or model you apply there, it's gonna be operating at a fairly low level and errors compound very rapidly in that domain or in that space. Also, it's very DUI. So I think as of today, it prevents a broad usage from mathematicians as it stands. So given that, let me present you how it works in hindsight. So given a goal, there is basically only one tactic in MetaMask, which is called substitution. Given a goal, you provide a theorem statement or a theorem that exists in the database, and you provide substitution for the free variables in that theorem statement. And the substitutions must be such that the conclusion of the theorem unifies to the current goal. And the substituted hypothesis of the theorem you provided becomes the new subgoal. So you're really proving backwards always. You can prove forwards as well, but really here we're gonna set us up in a place where we prove backwards. And so what happens here, we have a goal which is 3 + 2 = 5. We want to apply a proof step which has a theorem statement, which is a transitivity of equality. So we necessarily need to unify A with 3 + 2, C with 5. And we're left with providing a substitution with B, which is completely free here. And that's where generative models are a must-have, I think, for applying to MetaMask, because you always have those kind of substitutions that are completely open and requires some form of exogenous terms generation to be performed correctly and in a useful way. So in that instance, this is a proof from the MetaMask library. The substitution for B is 4 + 1. We are left with 2 subgoals. The lower subgoals becomes 5 = 4 + 1. It happens to be the definition of 5 in MetaMask. So we just apply that axiom or that theorem. The goal is closed here because there is no free variables. There's no hypothesis. So you don't need to provide any substitutions and you have no subgoal. And then you're left to prove with 3 + 2 = 4 + 1, which gets you one step closer. And the proof tree goes on like that. Okay, so the data set we extract is exactly that. It's a massive blob of JSON lines that includes the following data. We have the current proof, the proof that is being demonstrated, the name of the theorem. We have the goal in the proof tree that is considered. We have the proof step that has been applied, which is the theorem statement here. The substitutions for each of the variables. We have hashes for each of those proof steps, and we also represent the tree structure of the proof by having a parent hash for each of those proof steps. The train set, we split that into a train set with 36K theorems, roughly 3 million proof steps, a valid and a test set, each 1K theorems, 90K proof steps. Cool, so what is the training objective that we study? So we take that data set and we generate the following sequence. We have a goal keyword. We inject the goal statement right here. We have a proof step keyword and we inject the proof step statement here. as strings. These are just simple strings. And we then train generatively a transformer model to fit that distribution. And so what you have once you've fitted your model to that distribution is that given a goal, you can write goal, the goal that you have, the keyword proof steps, and what the model will do is make a prediction for the proof step that needs to come after that, that fits the distribution. So it's really pure imitation learning. To give you a sense of what it looks like, I'm gonna load the OpenAI API, that's the playground, it's loaded with our model. And so here the goal is this statement, which is 10 plus 3 equals 13. We have the proof step keyword. It's really just text, I can write anything, right? And so here I'm gonna submit that to the model, and the model generates a full CRM statement, which is here, which is called DCAD in MetaMask. It's basically applying the addition algorithm and then the set of substitutions that are necessary. We can check that EF unifies to 1, 3. So E is here, F is here. And then we can check that N plus N unifies to 10 plus 3. And then all of the new hypotheses becomes we have A must be an integer, B an integer, et cetera. And we have those sub-goals to prove which are produced by the substitutions. So that gives you kind of an intuitive idea of what exactly is the objective here. Going back to the presentation. So what we can do with that is we have already a prover. Why we have a prover is that you take a statement, you generate goal, statement, proof step, generate a proof step, send it to your kernel. The kernel says, yes, it's good. No, it's not good. If it's not good, you discard it. If it's good, it generates new sub-goals, and you keep going like that. You can use depth first search, breadth first search. In the very basic setup that we use a search that is slightly more complicated. We just prioritize the goals that we expand in the proof tree search by the cumulative log probability of the expansions that were made. So basically, we just prioritize the goals by how sure of itself the model was of the predictions that led to that goal. Just that gives us a prover. So if we use a 160 million model parameters, we get 28% close rates on the valid sets. Our first result is to demonstrate that the model size is positively correlated with the capability to prove statements on our valid sets. So increasing to 700 million parameters, we reach 31%. I think it's interesting to just demonstrate that larger model generalized in a slightly better way. And then the other thing that is really cool with those transformers is that we know that pre-training them on a bunch of data generally helps the final objective. And so here we have a system that we can pre-train on whatever we want. And then we just fine-tune that system after pre-training on the MetaMask datasets. And we can study how the pre-training influences the final performance. So from scratch, we're gonna focus on the 700 million parameters model. From scratch, we have 31%, but the same result as the previous slide. If we pre-train it on common crawl, which is just a big chunk of the internet, we jump to 39%, which is just weird, but interesting. If we then pre-train it only on GitHub, I mean, specialize it on GitHub, it's just Python code, we achieve 41%. And finally, if we pre-train it on what we call WebMass, which is a data set that is composed of 30% GitHub, 30% Stack Overflow, and 30% Matt Stack Overflow, sorry, and 30% archive Matt, then we reach 42%. So the first jump from scratch to common crawl is just massive, but the third jump from GitHub to WebMass is interesting. I think someone could argue that the features that emerges from the pre-training are probably very low level, right? Very syntactic. But the fact that training on GitHub is slightly, I mean, noticeably better, gets noticeably better when you're pushing on WebMats, demonstrate that the features that emerge are quite high level and do help formal math reasoning, which is interesting. Okay, so now the next thing that we believe is really fascinating about formal math is that you can, since you have a verifier, you can generate data. And the first type of data generation that we did and studied is training a value function. The idea is to simply learn from our errors. So what we do is we take the train model as we had before, and we sample proof on the training sets. Because we only stop to control for overfitting. We do not get 100% closure with perfect proof trees. We do get something like 50% closure. And most of the proof trees are much, proof tree search are much bigger than the proof itself. So that gives us an opportunity to label the goals that were visited as positive or negative. We label them as positive if they were demonstrated by the proof search, and negative if they were left open by the proof search. And so using that new data set, which is a data set that goes from a goal to a label, positive or negative, we can introduce a new autoregressive objective, which is given a goal, just predict one token, which is negative or positive. And that gives you naturally a probability function. The probability function is the probability of P given the goal. And it's roughly equal to 1 minus probability of N given the goal once the model is trained. And then as a value function for a goal, what we use is the product of the probability value for the siblings of the goal on itself. The intuition is very simple. If you apply a tactic to a goal, it generates a bunch of new sub-goals. To value those sub-goals, we take the product of their probability. So if one is very probable and one is very not probable, it shouldn't be valued as one very probable, because that would be exploring something that does involve proving a goal if we want to close a proof that is non-provable or hard to prove. So we take the product, which is kind of a natural way to do that. So using that system, we're gonna focus on the 700 million model as well. So iteration zero is the one that we described before, 42% close rate on the valid sets. If we sample all the proof on the training set, we label all the sub-goals that were visited, we add that new objective, we co-train using imitation learning, a new model on that, then using the new value function to do proof search, we raise to 44%. And the really interesting thing is that if you reapply the same mechanism iteratively, you keep going up in accuracy. You take your new model that has been trained with a value function, resample proof on the training sets, resample generally more proof that are positive on the training set, and you explore more positive sub-goals, you retrain on that new data set, and you get 47%. Finally, the last thing that we studied is the amount of test time compute that can pour in to and how it influences performances. So this is our kind of the last model from the last slides. When we evaluate, we have an hyperparameter, which is the number of time a proof statement is attempted, or number of time a proof tree search is attempted for a given theorem. And so we've used in all of the previous tables, 4 attempts. And so if you increase at test time the number of attempts, you can shift the close rate from 47% to 56%, which I think is also interesting. And really here, we demonstrate that this is the value that you get out of searching more against the verifier. So with that model, we've done 2 things. First, we've run the model on the MetaMask library. And we looked for shorter proof because MetaMask users are very keen on short proof. They want to keep their proof very short. They have general minimization efforts where they all go in and try to minimize. They have mechanical minimization efforts where they run algorithms on all the database. And so they were very keen for the model to find shorter proof than what they had before. In particular, there's a comment that is interesting. The shorter proof for int SS is easier to translate. It's more symmetric in that it treats A and B identically. It's physically more concise in that it doesn't rely on the existence of a universe class of all sets. I think the main feedback from that is that that model achieved some non-trivial reasoning, math reasoning capabilities, and that got the MetaMask community excited and got ourselves excited as well. We also created an online proof assistant that you can use. It basically calls the model for each proof steps, shows all the different generations that were suggested by the model, and the human can guide the model as the proof is constructed. It's a very nice setup because generally models makes errors that are easy to spot and correct by humans. And at other times, the model are capable of finding theorems in a way that is much more efficient than the human would do because they don't know the entire MetaMask library by heart. Whoa. And I think this is fresh out of the press. I shared the model with a French student that is 17 years old, 11th grade, yesterday. And he sent me back an email yesterday night telling that he was able to formalize his math exercise for the next day and that the model got it right. So that's exciting. I mean, I think there's something exciting when a 7-year-old student is able to pick up on MetaMask in less than 8 hours and formalize his math exercise for the next day. Okay, so I have a demo ready, but I'm pretty sure we don't roughly have time for it, but I'm happy to do it during over the questions or any time later that week. And otherwise, I think the main takeaway is the following. Language models, they do silly mistakes. We've seen it yesterday with the arithmetic datasets. Basically, if you take the best language model out there that has been trained on the entire internet, and you ask it, there is 3 apples on a plate, you remove 2 apples, you give them to John, John gives one to Mark, Mark eats 1 apple, everybody puts back their apple on the plate, you ask how many apples are left, and the models are generally completely incapable to say 2. Or they'll just say it randomly, and they have no consistency in their response. But I think that what we demonstrate here is that if you take a language model which is great at generating predictions, and you tie it closely with a verifier, which is great at verifying predictions, but very bad at generating predictions, you have a system in which you can do search that make emerge a capability of non-trivial formal reasoning. And I think that's described mostly through that increase in proof closure capability that goes from 28% or baseline to 56% with all the things that we've explored. There's also a large things that we, I mean, I think there's so much stuff that we can explore. We haven't explored that whole conjecturing statement and trying to prove them. We haven't explored pre-training on MISA, which seems like crazy because that would be so awesome to just pre-train on MISA and transfer to MetaMath. And so, and we also want to explore applying that to other form of system. We have Lean that we'd be very keen on working on. And so that's all the things that we're working on today. All right, thank you. If you have any question, I'm happy to answer them.
Thank you. More online questions? Online questions?
Oh, I can ask always a question. Nobody else wants to. So can you explain a bit more what the search is working like? Is it like Monte Carlo? Is it beam search? Or how do you do it?
Yeah, sure. So basically, that's how it works. We have the root search. We generate 32 tactics. Each of those tactics will be run through the verifier. So you won't get 32 expansions. You'll get maybe 16, sometimes 0, sometimes 2. And so these are the tactics. Each of those tactics generates new subgoals, right? And so we value the subgoals. Here it's the log prop valuation that I talked at the beginning, but we basically value the subgoals using the value network by multiplying the value we get from both those subgoals. And then we insert those subgoals in a queue, organize them in order by their valuation. And then that's the queue that we use to prioritize expansion. And we keep going.
So it's probably like tactic though, right? No.
Different, but I don't have the multiplication for heuristics
answer. And so we are only conditioned on the current goal. We don't condition on the root goal. We've explored it and it didn't yield any visible benefits.
And are the order of the goals determined? It's just that you always choose the easiest goal or the best goal?
We choose the most the goal that is the most provable according to the value network.
Okay.
So it's if we use log prop priority, it kind of favors breadth because as you go deeper in the tree, the log probs accumulates negatively. But if you have a value function, it kind of provides a more balanced tree search because if you expand something and the goal is deemed just worthless, it's not going to be expanded even if it's higher up in the tree.
Can I ask one more question?
Sure.
Okay.
Be quick.
You have like some term synthesis inside the search. Do you have term synthesis inside the search?
Yes. So the tactics generation is purely generative. So it generates the CRM statements. But it also generates the substitutions, and the substitutions are term synthesis, term synthesized.
Okay.
Oh, there are 3 more questions online.
Oh. Okay. I'll let François ask a question. Hopefully, he'll ask.
Okay. Quickly, and thank you for the presentation. I had a question on pre-training. I noticed on your slide that the basic pre-training, so the training on the common crawl, tend to perform much better on the 700 million parameters than on the 160 million. Do you think that it is because the pre-training sort of, if you have an over-parameterized model, the pre-training sort of teaches a transformer to sort of start with decent starting parameters. So it's less something about learning language and all that than just pre-training a very, very large model like the 700 million parameters.
Yeah, I mean, I think, so we're not in a over-parameterized mode for common crawl because the 700 million is really tiny compared to the size of common crawl. But I think it's the richness of the features that are extracted from the pre-training that is very viable in terms of the size of the model that we use. They all are completely pre-trained in the end of each regime, but I'm not sure if that answers the question.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, so I had a question about the context. So one issue with theorem proving is that you often have many, many, many lemmas and axioms and so on that you have to choose from. But it sounds like you only have the goal as context for the generation. So how does it know what's allowed?
So this is imitation learning. So it's learned the theorems that are existing in the MetaMask library by learning how to generate those proof steps by imitation learning. And we do generate those statements as the theorem statement, not as the theorem name. So here we have a very nice opportunity to letting the model conjecture and then letting it prove their own conjecture. Basically, it's pure imitation learning. It's gonna see a goal, it's gonna say, oh, I want to apply that theorem, and that theorem is gonna just generate the statement of it. And if it belongs to the MetaMask library, the verifier will accept it. Even if it's valid and true, but it doesn't belong to the MetaMask library, and that happens all the time, the verifier will reject it. Does that make sense? So it's learning, basically it's learning the parameters. It's that information is stored in the parameter from the learning objective.
Okay. I see. So I imagine that some theorems, there's an ordering to the way the theorems are proved. And so, you know, if A comes before B comes before C,
We enforce that ordering at eval time. And so many times the model will try to prove something with a consequence of a theorem, but that's rejected.
I see. Okay. Thank you.
No problem.
Thank you. I'm sorry. I think I'm sorry, Salta. We're kind of running a bit late. Thank you so much.
Thanks. I'm happy to answer any question, I think, of course.
Yes. Are you...
he's the next speaker.
Yeah, are you doing it from...
Yes.
Okay.
He will just replace
you. Well, you get to chair yourself.
I'll chair myself. All right, I will try.
Do you have a slide there?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
So, when do I have the Zoom here?
Just share screen.
Good, that makes sense. Good. I have some shit here. I don't know. Oh, it doesn't matter. Okay, whatever. I'm not sure if other people see this chat or not.
We see well. Yeah. I see well.
You see what is there.
Yeah, it's good. Yeah.
All right, fine.
We can go.
All right, so. Good. So I will present how we applied neural networks for formulas in the conjunctive normal form for automated theorem provers. This is based on graph neural networks. So first I will briefly explain what the graph neural networks are about, then how it differs from other similar experiments with graphs with formulas taken as graphs and treating them and using them for graph neural networks. Then I will show you what are the two logical environments that we were working with, in particular Linkop and eProver.
Sorry, I'm not seeing this slide.
You are not seeing this slide. All right.
I think we are seeing this screen.
Is it better now?
Yeah, you feel this.
But now these people are. Is it possible to synchronize the big board and the. Do I.
Have you tried to share again?
The big board is not synchronized with the.
I can also
with the.
I've had some strange experiences with this before. Let's just do some share.
You have some shit here.
Yeah. Yeah, this is some strange chat.
Sorry.
Let's try to share again. So, somehow it's twice here, right? So
I think it's screen two.
Screen two.
So why is this here twice?
So let's share screen
there
two.
Three times
now. Yeah, three this times.
Very strange. Yeah.
Well, what happens if you wait?
What about now? I need to focus there.
Focus where? Here or there? Yeah. Well,
good.
Yeah. Really? It's not changing on this computer,
yeah,
but in one place.
Yeah, yeah, somehow you can open multiple times.
Too many screens. All right, so this is about my content of my talk. First, I will talk about graph neural networks, then about how we encode formulas into graphs, then about the logical environments, such in particular Linkop and eProver, and in the end, I will show you the experiments. So graph neural networks is something that takes a graph on an input or on the input, and the nodes can be labeled, and also there are several edges of different sorts typically, and on the input the network will produce for each node some vector representation, and also it can produce some vector representation for the entire graph. And how this is done, it's actually not so difficult. So at the beginning, we initialize the nodes with some pre-learned vectors just based by the labels. So because these two nodes were both green at the beginning, they have the same initialized value. And then we take the values from the nodes and somehow pass them to the neighbor nodes along the edges. And then we collect what we get around every node and push it through some relatively simple neural network layer, some just linear layer with ReLU, with ReLU activation. And by this, we compute the next value for each node in the graph. And we iterate this process a few times. In our case, we iterated 5 times to 10 times, but some other, this is what is done in our networks. I'm aware that other people using graph neural networks can have the networks significantly deeper, but it was not very helpful in our case. And if we actually want the value for the entire entire graph, we just take the values of the nodes and somehow collect them using, let's say, maximum or average or something like that. In my case, it's, I think, both maximum and average taken together, so I have all the information. So this is briefly how what graph neural networks do. They just start with some pre-learned values, have a few or several message passing layers, and then they produce the vector representation. And now how to encode a formula as a graph? Well, at first it's kind of obvious that the mathematical formula is some sort of a tree. And if you think about the tree, you realize quite quickly that you don't that the names of the variables are not so much relevant, because you can name them in any way. There is this idea of alpha renaming, so it's actually better to just treat them as single node and say, all right, so now the variable doesn't make any label of the node, and it's just a node labeled as variable. And this is an approach that is already from a paper about so-called FormulaNet from 2017 by Mingjie Wang and others. And also there are similar networks doing, especially recently, there are other people trying to do something quite similar. I mentioned two papers that I've met. One from Michael Rosen, who is maybe attending this AITP, and other from Christian Segedian and this Paul and so on. And I think this list is even exhaustive. This is just like few examples showing that this is getting quite popular. And what's different in our setup is that we do it in particular for automated reasoning. And in the automated reasoning setup, we don't treat the formula in the sense that we have some variable bounds by some quantifiers, because at the beginning of the automated reasoning process, at the pre-processing, what typically happens is columnization. So we lose all the quantifier along the way, and also classification. So then the logical structure is somewhat very specific, but on the other hand, we have some new functions that such that their names don't really matter, because they were just produced as column symbols. So that means that if when we are encoding this formula into a graph, we actually reserve special nodes just for all the function symbols, and then we just connect these nodes to the appropriate position where we apply the function symbols. That's one of the thing that we do. So the formula so the network cannot see really which what are the symbols, what are even the function symbols. Other thing that I will not discuss this so much. But what is interesting is that concerning the logic, one thing is that we have this these clauses, so we also have special nodes that are representing just clauses, and these clauses are just linked through some edges to the particular literals. And other special thing is negation. So we have a negation here, and in the automated theorem proving, the negation is just some complementary label. So the only thing that we care about negation is that we want it to be complementary to other to the same thing which is negated. So the way how we treat it here is that we consider actually the relational symbol as negated, and by the very structure of the neural network, we don't just use any graph neural network framework, but we've implemented this by ourselves. By the very structure of the neural network, we force the node of, let's say, this inequality to be the real vector complement of the node of equality. And we preserve this property during the message passing layers. So these are the specifics of our networks. And what did we use it for? So we work with two logical systems. One is so-called LinkOp, which is a relatively simple theorem prover that builds a reputation tree, so that it has some set of axioms, and it puts these axioms it always finds some. So in this picture, let's talk about this picture. We want to somehow finish this QY, and we want to kind of kill this QY with the axioms that we have available, and we have actually two axioms that can kill this QY, either here or here, and therefore we just apply one of these axioms and put the rest of it to the bottom of the tree until we will be able to close all the branches and find the proof by it. And what I wanted to just tell about this is what the network actually gets, which is somewhat I would say that's what is a bit non-standard in what we are doing. So here the networks takes almost all the data that it can get. So it gets the current path, and not only the current goal, but all the remaining goals. And also it gets all the axioms, not only the available axioms. We have just the available axioms listed, but in general we have, let's say, set of 10, 15 axioms, and it gets all of these axioms. And it produces value and the action distribution, which is then used for some alpha zero like research, Monte Carlo research. So this is one of the logical systems. The other one is eProver, particular Enigma. So it's a saturating theorem prover. So this is some picture that I've stolen from Stefan, the author of E. So we have some process clauses and unprocessed clauses, and at every point we take some promising unprocessed clause and do plenty of things with it, which is, well, not what we really do, because eProver do it for us. But in particular, what happens is that this unprocessed clause is resolved with all the process clauses, and it produces many, many new unprocessed clauses. And the machine learning task is to which unprocessed clause to pick. And there is also other picture from Stefan that it rather looks like this, that set of unprocessed clauses is actually pretty big. So there is a question how to make it work well with some neural networks. And so the way how we do it again is that the network gets as input not only one unprocessed clause at a time, but it gets some batch of clauses. And also it gets all the process clauses, I believe. And oops. And this is one graph that is put into the neural network. So it's not just standard batching in neural networks where the inputs in the batch are independent, but here really the results of the neural network depends on the evaluation of the particular clauses, depends also on the other clauses that the networks evaluate. So these are the logical system, and now let's look at the experiments. So what typically happens in the experiments, even though we don't have very clear explanation of this, is that the networks tends to generalize quite well from the initial data. So at the beginning, it's performing pretty well, but over time, it's often gets caught by the other machine learning approach, which is gradient boosted decision trees. But on the other hand, it doesn't mean that the neural network is completely useless, because it actually solves somehow different types of problems than the gradient boosted decision trees. And so that's what I can tell about Linkop and Enigma. And last one, just kind of fun experiment that we did, is that we took, we also tried to use this for the premise selection on DeepMath dataset. And we measured the accuracy as usual, and we have kind of the state-of-the-art accuracy on this data set. But also what we did was that because our network don't get the function names on the inputs, we tried like how well could we train the network to actually predict the input, the function names. So we just gave the network the graph and trained it to guess for every node representing some function, to guess what is its original name. And it had about, let's say, 65% accuracy on this task, which looks reasonably high. This higher number, 78%, means that it was also guessing which functions and which, let's say, which other symbols came from some, either from solemnization or from some other procedure, preprocessing procedure, even though the network was not guessing the exact name, but just it came from this procedure. And then it was easier because there were many, many symbols like this coming from these procedures. So that's the end of my talk.
Just to manage the online questions, I guess. Can't do it.
I don't see any online questions. Are there questions? Yeah, there's.
In the Linkop experiment, you also gave this current path. Is it necessary to provide it, to provide the current path as a part of the input to the network?
Mm-hmm. Well, I haven't tried to not provide the current path. For me, it is reasonable to provide it, because it's kind of all what is on the current path is also something that can be used for closing the branch.
So I kind of thought that I want to provide the network the data that it can use for closing the branch, and it's also what is on the current path.
Yeah, but that sounds like interesting. Right? You could just give it the open goals and see like how bad it will be. Like I guess the issue is that the link of calculus will really force you to apply the clause to the current path, right? To the current goal. So if you choose a clause that applies to another goal, another open goal, then link will just say, sorry, you need to solve this goal first. Might not work so well.
There's one question in the chat.
No.
Oh, okay. I only saw the participants here.
Something I opened the chat.
Can you explain how you project the output predictions from the batch when graph nodes are shared within the batch?
Can you explain?
Can you see it?
Yes.
Okay. Well, we could unmute. Michael, you can unmute yourself if you want to say.
Hi, sorry, some background noise. So normally, if you don't have shared nodes, you can do something like global pooling, and you can average the nodes to get a single value out. Whereas if you have a batch where nodes are shared, how do you select the output prediction with respect to the Enigma stuff?
I'm still not sure what's the question. Well, in the Enigma, all right, let's go back to Enigma. There's nothing
pretty much. You need to be on the right screen
here. Okay, so we have this badge, which is somehow, this was primarily work of Jan Jakubů first, so maybe he could tell more precisely what's going on. But the idea is that we have as we are getting the unprocessed clauses, after a while we Jan takes these clauses together with the process clauses, construct all the graph. But in this graph, there are some nodes that are representing the clauses. And
These
clauses will get the value that we need. Right?
Yeah, so you project out these marker clauses. Yep, I got you. Thank you.
Okay, well, maybe we should go. Thank you.
We should be able to stop sharing.
Yes.
Yes, I can check.
Okay, Christian, you can.
Can you hear me?
Hello? Yeah, you are not sharing your screen yet.
Yeah. Okay. Can you still see it?
No.
No.
Okay. Let me check again. Oh, sure. Yeah, I have to press the button actually. Okay.
Much better.
Okay. Wait a second, so slide on. Yeah, so this talk is about learning alignment between formal and informal mathematics within our team at Google. So So this is a very preliminary work, but I'm still happy about how it's starting to shape up. But there's a lot of open questions that I will raise at the end, and also the whole thing is like it's just the start of a very long journey, I guess. But I think it's interesting. So there is this big challenge that we would like to be able to not just prove mathematical statements, but also formalize statements from natural language, which a lot of people actually think it's like ridiculously crazy hard, and other people think it's it will be very easy to do, but I think somewhere in between. So what is the problem with formalizing mathematics? So one challenge is that we have a lot of systems to formalize in, a lot of interactive theorem provers and also ATPs that I didn't list here. And informal mathematics, it has, like we don't have much paired data between the two, and what we want to actually achieve is like an almost commutative diagram between these two sets of data. So almost commutative means that if we translate from one to the other and back, then you get roughly the identity, and the identity means in more like a semantic sense that if you translate something to informal and then you go back to formal, then it should be like equivalent to the original statements. And on the other direction also, that you would like to have something that's semantically equivalent to your original statement. And the problem is here also that semantic equivalence is very hard to capture. And also, it's not just that we have a lot of corpora, we have a lot of corpora on the or a lot of theorem provers, we have a lot of corpora on the natural language side as well. And also, the real problem is actually that this graph was completely skewed in size, so the formalized mathematics is really, really tiny, so even this picture doesn't give a proper demonstration of how small is the formalized set of mathematics compared to the real informal mathematics, especially. So you cannot even compare in gigabytes, because informal mathematics is much more dense. So if you take half a page of informal mathematics, that might take like a lot of pages to formalize. It's like programming. So if you just want to put it in perspective, then imagine that we start figuring out which parts of the informal mathematics corresponds to formal mathematics, and you will see that you have here a bit of there, and then also you could do translations between all the various formal mathematical languages. So you could, for example, translate Coq to Hoolite or Lin to MetaMask or whatever. So all these things are possible. So you have a lot of translation stuff that you could come up with. So there is already existing works by Guillaume Lampe and others from Facebook AI, where they learned translation without alignment between different languages. So it's almost the same problem. The difference is that this task is relatively easy compared to what we want to do, because first of all, the two corpora are, even if they are not aligned completely, you don't have like parallel translations, they kind of cover the same topics, the same kind of area. So they are relatively comparable. It's not that you don't have this huge mismatch that in mathematics, like 99% of the informal mathematics, it doesn't even have a, so you cannot formalize, because you just don't have the notions to formalize them. So, and then they also similarly sized, and you don't depend so much on context. So if you want to formalize mathematics, then you need to know exactly what libraries to use. Even in the same interactive theorem provers, even integer numbers, you have different notions that cover the same, different definitions that cover the same notion. So integer numbers are can covered by multiple libraries, for example, and other surfaces as well. And you have different levels of abstractions, for example, as well. So it's very different, but not 100% different. So the question is, how can we salvage all those methods that people use for unsupervised machine translation for our purposes? So is it actually realistic to do anything? And what I would like to say, yeah, it's kind of like pointing in the right direction, but we need new ideas as well. So how does translation without alignment work? Is that you first you pre-train some language model using some pre-training methodology like BERT, you're masking out random words, or you do generative pre-training that you just predict next words, or missing statements prediction. Or you can use more adversarial methods like Electra that you replace words and then you want to find which words were replaced. So this way you can train language representations for a single language. So that's a kind of like you're training basically a denoising autoencoder by augmenting your language with various distorted sentences, and then you try to recover the original sentence. So this is the first step of alignment. And then the second is that you actually have to do some limited amount of anchoring as well. You don't need a lot of anchoring, but you need some level of word level translations. And then what people typically do is that you say, okay, if I have the same word in French, for example, same geographical locations like New York is in both corpus, then they should be embedded into the same. So they should be represented by the same embedding. So you share embeddings between the two languages. Okay. So why is it already a problem for formalization is that formal and informal mathematics, the tokens can be very different. So you, for example, in formal mathematics, you have like multiple words concatenated with an underscore. So are these actually same tokens or different tokens? So these are these kind of questions, and then you can start engineering some special purpose solution. But it looks like a mess if you start thinking about all this. And also LaTeX raises a lot of problems because you have a lot of formatting statements there that are irrelevant. So my suggestion is that, I mean, the simplest is just to use some character-based models and then see how far it gets. And then you, in order to do still anchoring, then you cannot really embed, I mean, character-level anchoring doesn't work really well. So you still need to do some kind of word-level translations for anchoring. And here is the thing that I tried, is that first of all, in order to do an auto-encoding task, like a denoising task, the idea is that try to kind of formalize the informal mass and informalize the formal mass a bit. So formalizing the informal mass is kind of like just dropping a lot of the filler words, dropping a lot of the formatting statement and symbols, dropping a subset of random subset of words, just like in BERT style. And also we make words lowercase and also do transformations that people do in language modeling. So for example, here is a list of all the words that I mean collected that occur very often, but they don't have, clearly they don't correspond to any mathematical notation. So we can just drop all these words anytime we encounter them from the informal mass. And then the denoising task for natural language becomes something like this, that you have the original text on the top, and then then we train a language model that it gets the bottom input and then have to reconstruct the output. But this is actually not a very aggressive transformation at this point. It's more like it's relatively, actually neural networks has a very easy time to do this kind of denoising. So we do even more aggressive, so drop even more words often. So the idea is that we start first with whole light pretty printed formulas. We augment them. We translate them word by word to natural language notions. So, I mean, the Olight, for example, it has like around 1,000 definitions that we can translate, so that you can translate it in a few hours. manually, and then we try to denoise it with another with the model that was trained on the previous task that I mentioned. So how well does that even that work? I mean, that's kind of like it doesn't even use cycle consistency in a way. It just say we have a natural language model that takes a suitable distorted input and tries to reconstruct a natural language output. And so the main failure mode is that you, if you train your network with not enough distortion, then the network still will just learn to copy. So it will just try to copy the input, and that will give a very decent next token prediction or next character prediction in this case. And so the trick is that you have to do a lot of very aggressive transformations to initialize this the second network in this diagram. So in this way, you get some system that first it translates. Actually it's wrong diagram. It should be natural language on the right side. Okay. So this is a better picture. So basically, the way that it works is that we first take the whole IPT print it, then augment it, first translate it, and then we translate it to natural language. So just look at the upper side of this diagram. And then in the upper side, you have to be very aggressive in this in applying distortions, otherwise this model will not work. But what will you do if you actually do it kind of right? I mean, I don't claim to be what's the right thing, but I mean, if you do it decently, then you can start getting informalizations like this, that you get an input that says that S is a proper subset of T, if then it follows that S is not T. So, and then it's not really a very good translation, but it's kind of it starts to infuse all kinds of interesting natural looking artifacts. And it's not so far from the semantics. So it's like a lot of things doesn't make sense. Like what is it? It's not proper S equal T. That's not a mathematically valid thing to say, or it's not increasing is even more stupid. But it's still, it generates like kind of natural looking statements. Or so, and then it also sometimes it both adds and drops certain parts of the original statement, but it kind of preserves a lot of the structure. But note that this whole thing was trained with a very stupid like denoising autoencoder. So it's like it was not really trained for really back and forth translations with cycle consistency. Or really outrageous errors are this that it creates is that for all S, every norm is convex. And then it just creates some bullshit tag that says all elements of S but as a ball, but a ball of the convex norm have been investigated. But because, I mean, it has seen a lot of these things, but, I mean, it's kind of still okay because it has the right notions and it creates some natural looking translations. And that's something we can go from. So how can we evaluate it? So one way to evaluate these translations is to take these stupid looking natural language sentences and then train another transformer network which translates these natural looking sentences back to pretty printed whole light expressions. And one way to measure it is just say, okay, we take some very simple similarity metric, like let's say TFID bag of word, and then say, okay, so how many of the translated expression end up being the closest match to the statements that we have started with. And actually even that very stupid system already gets like 96% recall. But I mean, that's also an artifact of the fact that our validation set is not that big. So in the CRM database, we have like 3,200 statements. So it's not such a big achievement, but I mean, it still shows that the whole thing is getting close to cycle consistent. So Okay, so this is our current state roughly, but I just wanted to like highlight what can we do going from here is that if you look back to the original problem formulation, so we want to create a system that is commutative in both directions. And one direction is something we could tackle so far. I mean, it's like tackled is a bit overstated, but that we could address is that that if we first informalize, then formalize, then it's kind of commutative. So you get close to the original statement, but it's much harder to get the other direction, that if you start with the informal statement and then you formalize, what happens? And the idea would be that we can use, again, a transformer model to mine parallel statements that have a high likelihood of being formalized versions of informal statements. So we already have a rough formalization model, then you can just say, okay, that is the log likelihood that some statement is actually an informalized version of a formal statement. So that way, we can carve out a small parallel corpus, and then we can start doing real cycle consistency. So that's one idea. The other idea would be also to use some less expensive mining methods for parallel set, like, for example, DFIDF, weighted similarity and stuff. So probably you want to do a combination of both to be fast. So also the question is, how natural are these translations? So, I mean, I showed you a few examples, and they kind of look more natural than the input, but they are not really great. So, but you can just also again train unconditioned language models and then use again the log likelihood of them to evaluate how natural those statements looks like. So this is not a new idea. I mean, all these unsupervised translation models, they originally they contained adversarial loss, which is actually almost the same thing here. So let me just conclude with a few important immediate problems that, I mean, this whole case is that one could go do as next steps is first is to improve the informalization. So in order to do that, we have to find a way to mine a parallel corpus and do the cycle consistency the other direction as well, because this cannot be done in a cycle of self-improving way. Also, how do we measure the quality of informalization? How do we provide an existing CRM database as a library so that it can use those notions in translation? So I think that's one of the most relevant practical problems that one has to solve. Also, measuring the formalization on statements that do not come from existing statements. So this recall number I showed is was like, go from whole life to natural language and back, and how close you get back. But what happens if your original informal statement didn't come from whole life? I mean, that's much more exciting. And and probably it's much worse. Also, segmentation into actual statements. Well, a lot of the statements we generate are not even like statements. They are just some fragments of text. So how can we figure out which parts of text actually corresponds to actual statements. Also measuring semantic correctness of translation. So for example, we translated something, did it translate back to valid whole-life expressions? So currently we look at pretty printed whole-life expressions, but we don't even validate whether they are syntactically correct, not to mention semantically. And definition, informalizing definitions is also raises a lot of problems. That concludes my presentation. So.
Either online or in line.
You are into the coffee time, right? So.
Yeah, for a while. Not too badly.
How big is the data set, Christian? Like you start just with the sort of
pretty printed whole light, how many formulas do you pretty print?
Oh yeah, so I use all the proof steps from all the whole light proofs, so it's 500,000 conclusions, yeah. I forgot to mention, but that's a very good question, yeah.
And like when you were showing these examples, what was the informal counterpart you were training on?
So that's the whole point, is that the informal counterpart is I just trained on a lot of informal corpora, and it's not, there is no real informal counterpart. So the system didn't know what these formulas are supposed to correspond to. So it just trained with a denoising autoencoder on the informal corpus, which is really large, and it covers like 10,000 times more than what I was training on the formal part. So that's why it's exciting, because there is basically this imbalance, and on the informal side, you, it's like there is no matching between the two, but it still is figured out something that's relevant.
It's unsupervised, I understand, but I was wondering, like, you always have two corpora, right? It's just the pair aligned, right? So you are saying that you train on everything you can get.
Yeah, that's my hands on. So it's basically Planet Mass, Wikipedia, Mass Overflow, Gutenberg books, open source textbooks, and stuff like that. So yeah, so that's much bigger than the informal. Yeah.
So Kevin has a question. So Kevin, can you?
Hi, you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
So, obviously, this is something I know not much about, this whole area of machine learning. But I've been talking to the people at the Stax project about there's hundreds of lemmas in Lean, which are also tags in the Stax project. And we just kind of thought, oh, let's just join everything up. And so we initially started to have some plan where we would put a tag in Lean where there was a corresponding Stax thing. But then it turned out that there was never some nice one-to-one correspondence. And, because some lemmas would somehow correspond to two tags, or one tag would correspond to 10 lemmas and half of something else. And is there any advice that you can give me as to how we're going to actually start gluing these things together in a way that can be helpful for you in the future?
So I guess even a rough alignment is better than no alignment. I think even if you are imperfect and say it's not really, I mean, it's the same notion, but it misses a few assumptions or whatever, or not 100% the same, but it's like that's the closest match. I think that even that kind of alignment, it would be useful to evaluate statements at least. So I think what we're still even missing is good test sets. I mean, if you would start to get some decent tests, that already would be a big advantage. So one thing we
what exactly do you want? Sorry.
So I mean, something on which we can test how good an algorithm performs. I mean, on which you can measure progress. So we don't even have a good test set. So if you would have some higher quality test sets on which we say, okay, this formalization is roughly the right thing, is like that's already would be a big advantage.
Okay, great, thanks. Oh, I was amused to note that the Stax project natural numbers start at 1, whereas the starts at 0.
Yeah, so that's what I'm saying, is that doesn't matter that much for these systems. So I mean, it's okay if you make these kind of like ambiguities, and if it's, you still like say, okay, it's not 100% the same notion, but it's kind of. I mean, for machine learning, it's fine. It's for a traditional approach, it would be disaster. But we try to embrace these ambiguities here.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We need to drink the coffee, so we might be 5 minutes late for the next session, if that's okay. yep. I will stop recording.